Osho Talk. Zen, The Path of Paradox, Volume 1, Number 5.
Keiichi, the great Zen teacher of the Meiji era, was head of Tofuku, a cathedral in Kyoto. One day, the governor of Kyoto called upon him for the first time. His attendant presented the card of the governor, which read, "Kitagaki, governor of Kyoto." "I have no business with such a fellow," said Keiichi to his attendant. "Tell him to get out of here." The attendant carried the card back with apologies. "That was my error," said the governor. And with a pencil, he scratched out the words, "Governor of Kyoto. Ask your teacher again." "Oh, is that Kitagaki?" exclaimed the teacher when he saw the card. "I want to see that fellow."
Existence is in continuous celebration. Accept man. Existence is a carnival, an orgy of joy. Accept man. Man has fallen out of this tremendous celebration that goes on and on. Man is no more a part to it. Man it seems aloof, alienated, as if man has lost its roots into existence. Man is a tree which is dying, drying, no more alive. Birds don't come to it. Clouds don't sing to it. Winds don't dance around it. What has happened to man and how? Why man is in such a hell? Why man is always in such a mess? There must be something very fundamentally gone wrong. The Zen analysis, the Zen diagnosis is that it is because man thinks he is. The trees don't think. They don't have a self. The rocks don't think. They don't have a self. The sky has no self. The earth has no self. Without self, there is no possibility of getting into misery. The self is the door to misery. Buddha called that atta, the ego, the self. We are miserable because we are too much in the self. What does it mean when I say we are too much in the self? And what exactly happens when you are too much in the self? Either you can be in existence or you can be in self. Both are not possible together. To be in the self means to be apart, to be separate. To be in the self means to become an island. To be in the self means to draw a boundary line around you. To be in the self means to make a distinction between this I am and that I am not. The definition, the boundary between I and not I is what self is. Self isolates. The self makes you frozen. You are no more flowing then. If you are flowing, the self cannot exist. Hence people have become almost like ice cubes. They don't have any warmth. They don't have any love. Because love is warmth, and they are afraid of love. If warmth comes to them, they will start melting, and the boundaries will disappear. In love, the boundaries disappear. In joy also, the boundaries disappear. Because joy is not cold. Except death, nothing is cold. The self is very cold. The self is death. Those who live in the self are already dead. Or maybe they were never born in the first place. They missed their birth. To be born, to be alive, means to be flowing, to be warm, to be melting, to be dissolving, not knowing where you end and where the existence begins. Not knowing the boundaries, to remain in that diffused consciousness. Certainly you are conscious, but there is no self-consciousness in it. Consciousness in itself is unself-consciousness. Consciousness can make man far more happier than anybody else on the earth. It is a great opportunity. But there is a danger lurking just by its side. Consciousness can turn any moment into self-consciousness. The moment consciousness turns into self-consciousness, that which was going to be a bliss becomes a curse. Then you are a dead thing here. Then you only pretend that you live. Only believe that you live. You only drag on. You only wait for death to come and free you from this so-called life. The Zen approach is how to make you again a unself, a no-self. How to dissolve the boundaries again. How not to cling to these boundaries. How to become open again. How to be vulnerable. How to be available to existence to penetrate you, to your very core. Says Lao Tzu, that everybody seems to be so certain of himself except me. Everybody seems to be so well defined except me. I remain undefined, he says. I remain kind of ambiguous. I don't know exactly where I am, what I am, what I am not. I don't know how to define the self and the other. I don't know where I and thou can be separated. Existentially, they are not separate. I is one polarity of thou. They are vibrations of the same energy. That energy which is speaking in me is listening in you. It is not separate. It can't be separate. It is one spectrum. It is one wavelength. It is the same wave that is speaking in me and that is hearing in you. It is the same energy that is man in you and woman in somebody else. It is the same energy that is human in you and vegetable in the trees. It is the same energy out of which the whole existence is made. It is one stuff in the rocks and in the stars. In man, woman, it is the same stuff. It is one whole. To lose this one whole and to become confined in the self is the misery. That's what hell is. Don't wait for any other hell. You are already there. Your ego is your hell. There is no other hell. Don't think that somewhere deep, hidden underneath the earth, there will be hell. It is already there. You are in it. It is in you. It comes with the ego. So we have to understand this phenomenon of the ego. Once we understand this phenomenon of the ego, Zen becomes very clear-cut. Then Zen is a very, very simple methodology. Once understanding arises in you what this self is, you can easily become an unself. That very understanding liberates you from the self. As the understanding arises, the self starts disappearing, just as you bring light in a room and darkness disappears. The first thing, when a child is born, he has no ego. He does not know who he is. He is simply blank. We start writing on him. We tell him, you are a boy, or you are a girl, that you are a Mohammedan, or a Hindu, that you are good, or that you are bad, that you are intelligent, or stupid. We start feeding him. We start giving him ideas, who he is. You are beautiful or not, obedient or disobedient, loved or not loved, needed or not needed. A continuous feeding of ideas. These ideas gather around in his consciousness. The mirror becomes surrounded by much dust, and certain ideas start getting fixed, getting rooted in the being of the child. He starts thinking the way you are teaching him. By and by, he completely forgets that he had come into the world as pure emptiness. He starts believing. And a child trusts infinitely. Whatsoever you say, he trusts you. He loves you. He does not know doubt yet. He does not suspect. And how he can suspect? He is such purity. He is just pure consciousness. He is pure love. The mother says something, he trusts it. Now psychologists say that if you go on telling a person one thing continuously, he will become that. You become that which you think you are. Not that you become, but that idea gets very much rooted. That's what all conditioning is. If you tell a small boy continuously that you are stupid, he will become stupid. He will start thinking that he is stupid. Not only that, he will start behaving in a stupid way. He has to adjust to a certain idea that is being given to him. When everybody thinks he is stupid, he also thinks he must be so. It is very difficult to think something which nobody thinks about you. It is impossible. Some support is needed. The child is very, very unsupported. He looks around. He looks into your eyes. Your eyes function like a mirror. He sees his face there, what you are saying. A child can become beautiful, can become ugly, can become a saint, can become a criminal. It depends on the conditioning, how you condition him. But whether he becomes a saint or a sinner does not matter. As far as the misery concerns, he will be miserable either way. Whether he becomes stupid or intelligent does not matter. Remember this point. Because conditioning brings misery. You can condition him as a saint and he will become a saint. But he will remain miserable. You can go and see your so-called saints. You will not find more miserable people anywhere else. Sometimes sinners may be joyous, but saints never. They are such great saints. How they can laugh, how they can enjoy, how can they dance, how they can sing. How can they be so ordinary and human? They are superhuman. They remain frozen in that superhumanity. It is nothing but pure ego. Zen is a totally different kind of religion. It brings humor to religion. It brings humanness to religion. It is not bothered about anything superhuman. Its whole concern is how to make ordinary life a blessing. Other religions try how to destroy your ordinary life and make you somebody extraordinary. Those are ego trips. They will not make you happy. They condition you. They respect you. Because you are good, the society respects. Because you are good, the parents respect. Because you are good, the teachers respect. And by and by, the idea gets into your mind, if you remain good, everybody is going to respect you. If you are not good, nobody is going to respect you. But respectability is not life. Respectability is very poisonous. A really alive man does not bother about respectability. He lives authentically. What others think is not a consideration at all. Gurdjieff used to say to his disciples, don't consider. Remember, never consider others. Because it is out of consideration for the others that the ego has arisen in you. It has to be cut root and all. Once the child starts getting fixed, he has a self. This self is a manufactured thing. It is a social byproduct. You really don't have it. You only believe it. It is a belief. And the most dangerous belief of all. In reality, there is no self. In reality, it cannot happen. Because you are not separate from existence. We are joined together into one universe. That is the meaning of the word universe, that it is one. It is not a multiverse, it is a universe. It is all one. In death, in life, in birth, in love, in hate, we are all one. We pulsate together. The breath that I am taking in has come from you. Just a moment before, it was your breath. Now it is mine breath. A moment later, it will be again not mine. It will be somebody else. You cannot even claim your breath that this is mine. It moves. We live in a sea of life. We live into each other. What belongs to you can belong to me. What belongs to me will belong to you. Just a moment before I started speaking, something was in me. Now I am pouring it into you. It will be yours. It will become yours. It will become your consciousness. It will become your memory. It will become your mind. It will be completely yours. Once a thought has been heard, understood, it is yours. Then it is no more mine. We are interlinked. So the self is a false entity created by the society for its own purposes. If you understand the purposes, you can go on playing the role, but you will not be befooled by it. The purpose is that everybody needs an identity card. Otherwise, things will become very, very difficult. Everybody needs a name. Everybody needs a certain address. Everybody needs an identity card, a passport. Otherwise, things will become very difficult. How to call somebody? How to address somebody? These are utilitarian things, needed, certainly needed, but they have no truth about them. They are arrangements. We call a certain flower rose. Not that it is its name. It has no name, but we have to call it. Otherwise it will be difficult to make a distinction between a rose and a lotus. And if you want a rose, it will be difficult to tell what you want. These are necessities. Yes, you need a certain name, a certain label, but the label and the name you are not. This awareness has to arise in you, that I am not my name, that I am not my form, that I am neither a Hindu nor a Christian, nor an Indian nor a Chinese, that I don't belong to anybody, to any sect, to any organization, that the whole belongs to me and I belong to whole. Nothing less can be true. This understanding, and your ego starts becoming looser and looser and looser, and one day you know you can use it. But you are not used by it. The second thing to remember, the ego is getting identified with a role, with a function. Somebody is a clerk, and somebody is a commissioner, and somebody is a gardener, and somebody else is a governor. These are functions. These are things that you do. These are not your being. When somebody asks, who are you, and you say, I am an engineer, your statement is existentially wrong. How you can be an engineer? That's what you do. That's not what you are. Don't get too much closed into your function. Because to become too much enclosed in the function is to become imprisoned. You are doing the work of an engineer, or the work of a doctor, or the work of a governor. But that does not mean that you are that. You can drop the work of the engineer, you can become a painter. And you can drop the work of the painter and you can become a sweeper. You are infinite. A child when born has infinity available. By and by, that infinity is no more available. He starts getting fixed into a certain direction. A child born is multidimensional. Sooner or later, he will start choosing. We will help him to choose. He will become somebody. There is a Chinese saying that a man is born as infinite. But there are very rare people who die as infinite. Man is born as infinite and dies as finite. When you are born, you were just pure existence. When you will die, you will be a doctor, or an engineer, or a professor. You have been a loser in life. When you were born, all alternatives were open. Infinite possibilities were open. You could have become a professor, you could have become a scientist, you could have become a poet. Millions of opportunities were available. All doors were open. Then by and by you settle. You become a professor. You become a professor of mathematics. Narrow and narrow you go on becoming. You become an expert, a specialist. Now you are like a small tunnel, which goes on becoming narrow and narrow and narrow. You were born like the whole sky. Soon you enter into a tunnel and you never come out of it. That tunnel is the ego. It is getting identified with a function. It is very insulting to think about a man as if he is a clerk. It's very insulting. To think about yourself that you are just a clerk is very degrading. You are gods and goddesses. Nothing less is true. Maybe more, but not less. When I say you are gods and goddesses, I mean your possibility is infinite. Your potentiality is infinite. Maybe you don't try to make that whole potentiality actual. Nobody really can make it. It is so vast. You are the whole universe. It will be impossible. Even in eternal time, you will not be able to exhaust your potentiality. That's what I mean when I say you are a god. You are inexhaustible. But something will become actual. You become very articulate. You become an orator. You learn language. You have a certain sense of words. You become a poet. You have a certain musical ear. And you love it. And you have a feel for sounds and you become a musician. But these are just very, very tiny possibilities of you. Don't think that you are finished with this. Nobody is ever finished with anything. Whatsoever you have done is nothing in comparison to that which you can do. And whatsoever you will do ever is nothing in comparison to that which you are. Ego means getting identified with the function. Certainly, a governor has a kind of ego. He is a governor. And he thinks he has arrived. A prime minister has an ego. He thinks he has arrived. What more there is? This is so foolish, so stupid. Life is so much. There is no way to finish it. There is no way. The more you enter into it, vaster possibilities open their doors. Yes, you can arrive at one peak and suddenly there is another peak. Non-ending. Man goes on being born every moment if he remains available to his potential being. The emphasis of the ego is on doing, and the emphasis of consciousness is on being. Zen is all for being. And we are all for doing. So we get miserable, because our beings are so big and we are forcing them into such small tunnels. That creates misery. That creates confinement. Freedom is lost. And you start feeling from everywhere hampered, blocked, prevented, obstructed, hindered. You start feeling limited from everywhere, but nobody is responsible. It is you. A man of understanding functions, works thousand in things, but always gets out of them. When he goes to the office, he may become a governor. The moment he steps out of the office, he is no more a governor. He is again the holy sky. He is again the God. He comes home, he becomes the father, but he does not become identified with it. He loves his wife, becomes a husband, but does not get identified with it. He has to do thousand and one things, but he remains free of all functions. He is a father, he is a husband, he is a mother, he is a brother, a child, a teacher, a governor, a prime minister, a president, a sweeper, a singer, thousand and one things. But still, he keeps free of all these. He remains transcendental. He remains beyond. Nothing can contain him. He moves through all these rooms, but no room becomes his imprisonment. In fact, the more he moves, the more free he becomes. Just see to it. When you are in the office, be a clerk, be a commissioner, be a governor. That's perfectly okay. But the moment you get out of the office, don't be a governor, don't be a clerk, don't be a commissioner. That function is finished. Why carry it? Don't walk on the road as if you are the governor. You are not. That governorship will be heavy on your head. It won't allow you to enjoy. The birds will be singing in the trees, but how a governor can participate? How a governor can dance with the birds? And the rains have come, and a peacock may be dancing. How a governor can stand there in the crowd and watch? Impossible. A governor has to remain a governor. He goes on his way. He never looks here and there. He never looks to the greenery of the trees, never looks to the moon. He remains a governor. These fixed identities kill you. The more fixed you are, the more dead you are. So this has to be remembered. You are not confined by anything that you do. Your action is very, very irrelevant to your being. Your action is not at all meaningful as far as your being is concerned. People come to me sometimes and they say, what about past karma? What about past lives? Because I say you can become enlightened in a single instant. Hence they ask, what about the past karma? I say karma is never a confinement. Action is never a confinement. If you remain confined, that is simply because you want to remain confined. Otherwise, there is no confinement. Just as you get out of the office and you drop out of your function of the governor, each life you can get out of that life. That dream is over. Sweet are nightmares, but it is over. You get out of it. This is what a meditator is constantly doing. Each moment he gets out of the past, drops the past completely. It is no more there. It does not hang around. He is free of it. Then there is no karma. Karma is not hindering you. You are clinging to it. And this is a habit, just a habit. And you are practicing that habit continuously. When you are not with your wife, you are not a husband. How you can be a husband without the wife? It is simply foolish. When you are not with your child, you are not a father or a mother. How you can be? When you are not writing poetry, you are not a poet. When you are not dancing, you are not a dancer. Only when you dance, you are a dancer. In that moment, you pulsate in a certain function as a dancer. But that is only for the moment. The dance stops, the dancer disappears, you are out of it. This way one keeps oneself free, floating, flowing. I have heard the king's jester punned so incessantly that the king in desperation condemned him to be hanged. However, when the executioners had taken the jester to the gallows, the king, thinking that after all a good jester was not easy to find, relented and sent a messenger post haste with a royal pardon. Arriving at the gallows just in time, where the jester stood with the rope already about his neck, the messenger read the king's decree, to the effect that the jester would be pardoned if he would promise never to make another pun. The jester could not resist the temptation of the opportunity. However, for he cackled out, "No news is good news," and they hanged him. Past karma. Your past life is no more there. How it can go on hanging around you? It hangs only because of your habit. You go on practicing it. In this life you are practicing. The day you stop this practice, you are free of it. In a single moment, all past can be dropped. This is one of the great messages of Zen. Instantaneously you can become enlightened. All other religions are very miserly about enlightenment. Zen is not so. They are very miserly, very business-like. They say the account has to be closed, your bad karmas has to be balanced by your good karmas. It will take time. It is not easy. And you have been here for eternity, almost for eternity. And you have done so many things, if everything has to be cleared, it seems impossible. Meanwhile, while everything you are clearing of the past, you will be doing many other things, they will become your future problems. You will be eating, you will be breathing at least, and when you are breathing, you are doing violence. You will be eating, you will be doing violence. You will be living, and life is violence. So something again is gathering around. Then this will be a vicious circle. You can never get out of it. The Zen illogic, or the Zen logic, is very, very clear. Zen says, you can get right this moment out of it all. Because it is just a clinging from your part. Not that the karmas are clinging to you, you are clinging to them. If you stop clinging, finished. And how one stops clinging? One has to start in the actual life, this life. Be a husband and never be a husband. That's what I mean when I say a sannyasin has to be a perfect actor. Be a mother and never be a mother. Don't get identified with the role. It is a role. Fulfill it. Fulfill it as perfectly as possible. Fulfill it as aesthetically as possible. Fulfill it as lovingly as possible. Enjoy fulfilling it. Let it be a work of art. Be a beautiful wife. Be a beautiful mother. Be a beautiful husband. Be a beautiful lover. But don't become that. The moment you become, you are getting into trouble. So don't allow functions to settle on you. Don't allow roles to settle on you. Exactly be like a skillful actor. The actor goes on doing many roles. Sometimes he is a father, and sometimes he is a mother, and sometimes he is a murderer, and sometimes in a very serious role, and sometimes playing just a ridiculous part. But he goes on playing all parts alike, perfectly. He is not bothered with what part he is playing. He remains skillful. He brings all that he has got into it. If you make him a murderer, he will be the best murderer in the world. If you make him a saint, he will be the best saint in the world. And you can change. In one act, he is the saint, and another act, he becomes the murderer. But his perfection remains intact. This fluidity has to happen in life too. Life is a big drama. Yes, the stage is very big. The whole earth functions as a stage. And all the people around here function as actors. And nobody knows where this whole is going, to what end. The story is not given. It has to be created. It has to be improvised moment to moment. Yes, there are in Zen certain dramas which are called no dramas. No script exists. Just the actors are there. The curtain is raised and they improvise. Things start happening. Something is bound to happen when people are there. Even if they sit silently and look at each other, something is happening. Something is bound to happen. Without any preparation and without any rehearsal, something is bound to happen. Exactly, life is like that. Moment to moment. Go on slipping out of the past, and whatsoever is going to happen, allow it to happen. Uninhibited, without any depression, go into it as totally as possible, and your freedom will grow. Another thing before we enter this story. The ego, or the self, is the part pretending to be the whole. Just as if my hands pretends to be my whole body, then there will be difficulty. We are parts of a infinite universe, and we start pretending to be the whole. The ego is a kind of madness. It is neurosis. It is megalomania. And the ego is very, very mad. If you listen to it, you can see to its madness. It thinks all is possible. It thinks it can conquer the whole. It can conquer the nature. It can conquer God. It thinks in terms of conquering. It thinks in terms of aggression. It thinks all is possible. And all can be done. And it goes on becoming more and more ambitious. It goes on becoming more and more mad. In China, there is a very ancient Zen story. The monkey. The monkey is one of the most ancient symbols for the mind, for the self, for the ego. The monkey is a metaphor for the stupidity of the ego. And this story is rare. Only sane people can write such a story. No other religion can be so courageous. For other religions, for Christians, for Hindus, for Mohammedans, it will look sacrilegious. It will look disrespectful towards Buddha or towards God. It is not. Zen people love Buddha so tremendously that they can even play jokes upon him. That is out of great love. They are not afraid. Zen people are not God-fearing people, remember. They are God-loving people. And when you love somebody, you can laugh also. And they know by their laughter, Buddha is not reduced. In fact, by their laughter, they are offering their love. This story has been condemned by other religions. Yes, it is certain Christians cannot write such a story about Jesus. Neither Jainas can write such a story about Mahavira. Nor even Hindu, Indian Buddhists can write a story about Buddha like this. Only in China and Japan. Religion came to such a glorious growth that it became possible. Humor became possible. Listen to this story. The monkey came to the Buddha. The Buddha said to the monkey, I will have a wager with you. Because the monkey was claiming he can do everything. He was no ordinary monkey. He was like Alexander the Great. He was saying impossible. The very word does not exist in my dictionary. I can do everything. He was a great monkey. At least he believed. Buddha said, I will have a wager with you. If you are really so clever and so great, jump off the palm of my right hand. If you succeed, I will tell the Jed Emperor to come and live with me in the Western Paradise, and you shall have his throne without more ado. But if you fail, you shall go back to earth and do penance there for a kalpa before you come back to me with your talk. This Buddha, monkey thought to himself, is a perfect fool. I can jump 108,000 leagues, while his palm cannot be as much as 8 inches across. How could I fail to jump clear of it? You are sure you are in a position to do this for me? He asked. Of course I am, said Buddha. He stretched out his right hand, which looked about the size of a lotus leaf. Monkey put his khadgal behind his ears and leapt with all his might. that's all right. He said to himself, I am right off it now. He was whizzing so fast that he was almost invisible. And Buddha, watching him with the eye of wisdom, saw a mere whirligig suit along. Monkey came at last to 5 pink pillars, sticking up into the air. This is the end of the world, said monkey to himself. All I have got to do is to go back to Buddha and claim my 4 feet. The throne is mine. Wait a minute, he said presently. I would better just have a record of some kind in case I have trouble with the Buddha. So at the base of the center pillar, he wrote, the great sage, equal to heaven, reached this place. Then to mark his disrespect, he relieved nature at the bottom of the first pillar and somersaulted back to where he had come from. Standing on Buddha's palm, he said, well, I have gone and come back. You can go and tell the Jade Emperor to hand over the palaces of heaven to me. You stinking ape, said Buddha. You have been on the palm of my hand all the time. You are quite mistaken, said the monkey. I got to the end of the world, where I saw 5 flesh-colored pillars sticking up into the sky. I wrote something on one of them. I will take you there and show you if you like. No need for that, said Buddha. Just look down. Monkey peered down with his fiery, steely eyes. And there at the base of the middle finger of Buddha's hand, he saw written the words, the great sage equal to heaven reached this place. And from the fork between the thumb and first finger came a smell of monkey's urine. Now this monkey is the metaphor for the ego. The ego thinks it can do everything. It lives with this fallacy. The part lives with the fallacy that it is the whole. The impotent ego lives with the fallacy that it is omnipotent. The ego, which does not exist at all, thinks it is the very center of the whole existence. Hence the misery. We go on making all kinds of efforts and they all fail. Because the very presupposition is false. Man goes on trying to succeed and never succeeds. And all success brings frustration. We have piled much money and we have piled many devices and we have progressed much in science, but misery grows. Misery is more than ever today. It should not be so. Logically, it should not be so. Our century is the most scientifically advanced century. Man has never been so affluent. And man had never so much technology to exploit nature. But man has never been so much miserable either. What has gone wrong? The very presupposition. For no self, everything is possible. For the self, nothing is possible. If you want to conquer the world, you will be defeated. If you don't want to conquer, you are the conqueror. In surrender to existence is victory. Will does not lead to paradise. Only surrender. So remember these things and enter into this small parable. Kechu, the great Zen teacher of the Meiji era, was the head of Tofuku, a cathedral in Kyoto. One day the governor of Kyoto called upon him for the first time. His attendant presented the card of the governor, which read, "Kitagaki, governor of Kayato." "I have no business with such a fellow," said Kechu to his attendant. "Tell him to get out of here." The attendant carried the card back with apologies. "That was my error," said the governor. And with a pencil he scratched out the words, "Governor of Kayato. Ask your teacher again." "Ah, is that Kitagaki?" exclaimed the teacher when he saw the card. "I want to see that fellow. What has happened?" A very simple story, but of tremendous import. Now comes this governor to see a Zen master. He writes his name Kitagaki, but he cannot forget that he is the governor of Kayato. And when you come to a master, you have to forget that. Otherwise, you can't come. You may come physically, but spiritually, you are far away, miles away. The governor will stand in between. The function will stand in between. And how a governor can come to a Zen master? A man can come, a woman can come, but not a governor. Governor is a function. Consciousness can come, but not the ego. Seeing the card, the master says, "I have no business with such a fellow." He does not understand the ABC even. Why he should bother to come? You come to a master only in deep humbleness. Because learning is possible only in humbleness. You have come to learn, not to show who you are. You have come to surrender, not to perform, not to manipulate, not to impress. You have come in deep humility. Only then you come. If you come with certain ideas that you are this and that, you don't come at all. But we carry our function as our mask. The original face remains hidden. If you have much money, the money is on your face, hiding your original face. If you have some prestige, that prestige is on your face, hiding your real face. If you are on some political trip, that politics is there. A Zen master is no ordinary religious teacher. He is not a priest. He is not a pope or a Shankaracharya. He believes in no hierarchy. He wants to see directly, and he wants you to see him directly. He does not want anything to hinder, to stand in between. Now this governor will stand in between. Now because of this governor, the master will not be able to penetrate to Kitagaki. And the Kitagaki will not be able to understand the master. This governor is going to be too much of a thing in between. It will not allow communication. Naturally, when you are a governor, you are not relaxed. You are tense. When you are a governor, you are not ready to listen, you are ready to order. When you are a governor, you cannot bow down. You cannot surrender. You would like the Zen master to surrender to you. The master is perfectly right when he says, I have no business with such a fellow. Tell him to get out of here. It looks rude. It is not. It is out of deep compassion. It looks rude because we have become too much accustomed of formalities. But a Zen master is no more a part of your formal world. That's why he is a Zen master. He lives outside society. He is a dropout. He is a rebel. He does not bother about your formalities. Because with the formalities, the lie continues. And with the formalities, the ego continues. The ego is supported by all kinds of formalities. He has pulled the very earth beneath the governor's feet. He has pulled all props. He said, I don't want to see such a fellow. Hard, rude, it appears on the surface, but go into it and see the compassion. He would have not cared if he was not very much compassionate. He would have said, okay, bring that fellow and let him have an interview and be finished. And why bother? But he wants that fellow really to come in. And that fellow cannot come in with that idea of being a governor. The governorship has to be left outside the door. The old mind has to be left outside the temple. He has to come as a clean slate. He has to enter in the temple as a child with no idea who he is. Then things can start. Then the spark of the master can ignite something in the fellow. It is out of compassion, remember. Sometimes masters have been very hard because of compassion. Almost cruel. And Zen masters more so. Once a great politician, a prime minister, Kuatazo, went to see a Zen master. He asked the master, Your Reverence, how do you explain egotism? The Zen master's face suddenly turned blue. And in an extremely haughty and contemptuous manner, he said to the premier, What are you saying, you numbskull? This unreasonable and unexpected defiance so hurt the feelings of the prime minister that a slight, sullen expression of anger began to show on his face. The Zen master then smiled and said, Your Excellency, this is egotism. And Zen masters are very, very realistic, very pragmatic, down to earth. They believe in immediacy. They don't believe in explanations. They hit hard to wake you. Now, if this prime minister has gone to somebody else, to a Hindu saint or to a Jaina saint, they would have explained with long explanations. They would have explained the theory, the philosophy behind it. They would have dissected the whole idea. But this Zen master simply hits the nail there. Rather than going into the theory, he simply goes into the facts. He creates the situation. He makes the premier angry. Suddenly, the ego is no more a theoretical problem. It is an actuality. an immediate fact. The ego is arising. The smoke is already there around the consciousness of the premier. And then he says, Your Excellency, this is egotism. Now he has created something. Now it can be pointed out directly. It looks hard to call this poor man, who was not asking anything absurd, a very religious question, what is ego? What is egotism? And says Zen Master, what are you saying, you numbskull? And then too, this Zen Master was not very, very Zen. Because Zen Masters are known to hit, to shout, to jump on you, to throw you out of the door. To create a situation in which the problem becomes real. And you can be awakened to the problem directly. Zen is direct. It does not believe in indirect things. The attendant carried the card back with apologies. That was my error, said the governor. And with a pencil he scratched out the words, Governor of Kayato. Ask your teacher again. The man must have been of great intelligence. Otherwise, ordinary governors are not known to act that way. An ordinary governor would have become angry. An ordinary governor would have taken revenge. But he understood it. Must have been a man of rare intelligence, of great understanding. Was not a stupid fellow. He understood it. He could see into it. He could see the compassion of the master, the hint, the indication. A very subtle hint was there. If he was not very, very intelligent, he would have missed it. And it happens many times. Many people miss. Because the hints are very subtle. The reality is so subtle. He must have been able to read into the master's compassion. He didn't get angry. He didn't become disturbed. He must have seen the fact why. Why the master has said, I have no business with such a fellow. It was so clear. If you are alert, things are really so clear. If you are not alert, then things are not clear at all. And when you are not alert, your inner anger, your reaction will make things even more confused. That was my error, said the governor. He scratched out the words, Governor of Kayato. Ask your teacher again. Ah, is that Kitagaki? Exclaimed the teacher when he saw the card, I want to see that fellow. Things had changed utterly. Just by dropping a single word, Governor of Kayato. Can that small change bring such a great change? Yes. Life consists of very small things. The ego is not a very big thing, very small. But while you are suffering from it, it looks very big. If you are intelligent to drop it, it looks very small. It is just like a small particle of dust in your eye. When it is in your eye, it looks as if the whole Himalaya has fallen into your eye. All looks dark and you are getting blind. and it is irritating. But when you take that small particle of dust and put it on your palm, and you see it is so small, exactly like that is the ego. Once you start seeing it, it is not a big thing. And life consists of very small changes. A small change and the shift and the gestalt changes. Now, you have to understand what happened inside the man. This is just on the outside. He scratched the word governor of Kayatu. But inside what happened? He scratched something there too. And that is far more important. That is really important. He scratched his function. He scratched his role. He scratched his identity. He became a clean seat. He scratched the idea that I am somebody. He forgot all that he had learned up to now. At that moment, he dropped all that. He does not know who he is. So why pretend? Yes, he works as a governor, that's okay. But what that has to do with a Zen master? And why a Zen master should bother whether you are a governor or not? And this small change inside can change the whole world. A human brain is divided in two parts, two hemispheres. Now, scientific research has shown many facts about the human brain. One side, the right hemisphere of the brain, functions in a totally different way than the left side. And they are bridged by a very small bridge. And through that bridge, the gear changes. The left side brain functions through reason. It is prose. It is logic. It is aggression, ambition. It is ego. It is male. It is young. It is very violent. This left hemisphere of the brain is the hemisphere of mathematics, action, analysis, sequence, masculinity, time, aggression, work, all kinds of such things. And they are bridged by a very, very fragile bridge. And you continuously change from the left to the right, from the right to the left. In fact, that's why your breathing changes. Sometimes you are breathing from the left nostril, and then the change. You start breathing by the right nostril. When you breathe by the right nostril, your left hemisphere functions. Crosswise they are connected. When you are breathing by the left nostril, your right hemisphere functions. Your left hand is joined with the right hemisphere. Your right hand is joined with the left hemisphere. That's why we force children, if they write by their left hand, we force them to write by the right hand. It seems right is right and left is wrong. Why? A child who writes by his left hand will never be the type of man this society requires him to be. He will be more poetic, more imaginative. He will have great dreams. He can become a painter, a dancer, a singer, a musician. But he will never be skillful in mathematics, engineering, science. He will not become a great general, a murderer, a politician, no. For all that, left hand is dangerous. Right-handed people are needed. The history is made by right-handed people. Left-handed people have to be changed, because if you use the left hand, your imaginative part, your feminine part will function. Your egolessness will function. You will be more soft, open. You will be more receptive. So we force children. Sooner or later there is going to be a revolt against the right-handed people by the left-handed people. They have to revolt. In fact, 50% people are left-handed. Because there is a balance. But we force them. Out of 50%, almost 40% people reluctantly become right-handed. 10% persist, but they too persist with fear, anxiety. Something is wrong. It is not only a question of hands, it is a question of the inside brain. Just now, linguists have become aware that there are two kinds of languages in the world. Few languages function from the left hemisphere. For example, English functions from the left hemisphere. It is a scientific language, more rational. The language of the Hopis functions from the right hemisphere. It is a totally different kind of language, more pictorial, less scientific, more poetic, more colorful, more alive. Hopis cannot develop mathematics much. We have been forced to remain more and more in the left hemisphere, and we have by and by forgotten the right hemisphere. We have forgotten the very world of the right hemisphere. When you drop the ego, this change happens inside. That's why all great masters have insisted for surrender. It has nothing to do with the outside. It is something very deep inside. When you surrender your ego, when you say that I trust you, and that now I will follow you, that now I will be your shadow, now whatsoever you say will be the law, suddenly your left side brain stops functioning. There is no need for it to function. Doubt disappears. Reason disappears, so doubt disappears. Argumentation disappears. A totally different kind of energy arises in you. You become more poetic, more celebrating, more joyful. And then growth happens. The growth is through the feminine. The growth is through the right hemisphere. So this parable is just symbolic. The governor understood it. He said, okay, I will drop this idea of being a governor. By scratching the idea that I am the governor of Kyoto, he shifted from his left hemisphere to right hemisphere. And only with this shift something is possible. Chuang Tzu, telling the story of the spirit of the ocean, is speaking to the spirit of the river, says, you cannot speak of ocean to a well frog. The creature of a narrower sphere. You cannot speak of ice to a summer insect. The creature of a season. You cannot speak of Tao to a pedagogue. His scope is too limited. But now that you have emerged from your narrow sphere and seen the great ocean, you know your own insignificance, and I can speak to you of great principles. This is what the ocean says to the river when the river falls into the ocean. Up to that moment, the ocean has kept quiet and has remained silent. The river was there, hesitating whether to go into the ocean or not, and the ocean was silent. Then the river falls into the ocean, and the ocean says, "But now that you have emerged from your narrow sphere and seen the great ocean, you know your insignificance, and I can speak to you of great principles." Exactly that is what happened. When Kitagaki said, "Yes, I was wrong." This feeling that I was wrong is a radical change. It is very difficult for people to accept that I am wrong. They go on defending. They go on rationalizing. The more easier thing would have been for Kitagaki to think that this man is arrogant, egoistic. Just if you were there, inside Kitagaki, what would have happened, just think. You would have thought this man is arrogant. What kind of master he is? A master has to be very humble. A master is the very incarnation of humbleness, and this man is very egoistic, and he does not know even etiquette. He is rude, primitive. He would have been angry. He would have found 1001 rationalizations. People go on insisting for their rationalizations. Said the worried patient to the psychiatrist, "I am in love with my horse." "But that's nothing," replied the psychiatrist. "A lot of people love animals. My wife and I have a dog that we love very much." "Ah, but doctor, it is a physical attraction that I feel toward my horse." Said the psychiatrist, "What kind of horse is it, male or female?" "Female, of course," the gent shot back angrily. "What do you think I am, queer?" You can always find something to defend. You can defend your foolishness. You can defend your disease. You can defend your neurosis. You can go on defending your state in which you are and suffering. You can defend your suffering and misery. People defend their hell so hard. They don't want to get out of it. The moment the governor said, "Yes, I feel my errors," the whole of his inner being changed. The moment you say, "Yes, I am in error," have you watched that moment? What happens? Suddenly, a tension is gone. Now there is no defense. Now you need not be defensive. Now you can open. The moment he is crushed, the world's governor of Kayato, he became a different kind of man. He was no more the same person, remember. That's why the master says, "Ah, is that Kitagaki? I want to see that fellow." Now it is a totally different kind of person. In a pub, two persons were sitting. "I am going to leave this job and I want you to come with me," said one of them after his eighth drink. "Ah, really?" remarked his pal. "Yeah, I know a place in Africa where there is a lot of gold just lying around waiting for someone to pick it up." "I knew there was a catch to it." "What is the catch?" "You have got to bend over." When you come to a master, you have got to bend over. And that is the most difficult thing in the world. It is not just a formality in the East that you touch the feet of the master. It is not. It is just symbolic. It has become a formality, that's why it has become meaningless. But if you really touch the feet of a master, something tremendously changes inside you. You are no more the same person. You have scratched the governor of Kayatu. You are freer, openers, ready to receive. You are more feminine the moment you touch the feet. You are more passive, available. You are ready to go with the masters. The journey is of the unknown. You have to trust. There is no way to prove anything about it. You have not known it. You have not experienced it. There is no way to prove that it even exists. You have to believe. You have to trust. It is just like a bird is teaching her children to fly in the sky. They have never flown before. They have just come out of the eggs. They are just getting ready. They don't know even that they have wings. They have. But how can you know unless you have been in the sky? How can you know that you have wings? The mother is teaching. How she teaches? She goes out. She flutters around. Those children are watching. They start feeling something arising in them. Yes, they would also like the same way. But they are afraid. They are just there, sitting on the edge of their nest, fearful, frightened. And the mother comes and goes again and persuades them, "You come, please." Maybe one child, courageous, a little ready to go into danger, jumps. Yes, it is very awkward, his jump. His flight is not much of a flight. Within minutes he is back, but now he knows. He has wings. Now it is only a question of time to learn the skill. But he is capable of it. Sometimes the mother has to push the children. Just push them so they become aware of their wings. Same is the situation of a master. You have to trust like a child trusts the mother. He is taking you on a journey you have never been before. In fact, he is taking you on a journey about which you have not even dreamt what to say about experiencing. He is taking you on a journey about which you have not even heard. You cannot hear even if somebody is saying about it. It is so unfamiliar. He is changing your whole mind. He is bringing you to a metamorphosis, a transformation, a metanoia. Sometimes he will pursue it. Sometimes he will push. But once you are in the sky, you will know. And you will be grateful forever. And the beauty is that he has not given you anything. The wings are yours. The energy to fly is yours. The sky is yours as much as the master's. He has not given you anything. But still, he has given you a lot. He has given you courage. He has given you the possibility of trusting, of going for a new adventure, of going into the unknown. But surrender is a must. I है. इज दैट किटागाकी? आई वॉन्ट टू सी दैट फेलो. दैट इज स्क्रैचिंग ऑफ द नेम हैज बिकम ए सिंबल फॉर सरेंडर एंड ही हैज अंडरस्टूड हिज एरर. दैट्स वेरी इंडिकेटिव. नाउ द मास्टर इज रेडी टू रिसीव हिम. The master can receive you only when you are ready to be received. Before that, it will be premature. It will not be of any use. It will not help you. Had the master been a little more formal, the governor would have missed. Because the master was not formal, the governor had an opportunity to grow. And he has grown, and this growth sometimes happens in a single moment. Intelligence needs no time. If you are intelligent, what I am saying is already happening in you. If you are stupid, then you have to think about it. Otherwise, the moment I am saying something, something is continuously happening in you. Here I say, there it starts happening. You start feeling for it. You start having a taste of it. You start fluttering your wings. You start getting ready to take a jump. You start getting courageous. You start getting attracted towards the very risk of it. While I am saying something, if you are intelligent, there is no need to do anything. It would have happened even while hearing. Buddha has said that there are two types of people: those who attain to truth just by hearing, and those who have to do much. The second category is mediocre. Now you will be surprised. The second category has become very important. The first he calls sravaka. Exactly the same word as Mahavira uses. Those who attain by just hearing, sravaka. And the second he calls sadhu. Those who cannot attain just by hearing, but have to do much. They have to do much because their intelligence is not enough. Otherwise, intelligence is liberation. Heard rightly, it has already happened. Then any situation can be the opportunity. Zen calls this state of mind musin. Musin means a state of no mind, of pure intelligence. No thoughts moving around, just the flame of awareness. In this state, the observer is no more separate from the observed. Knower is no more separate from the known. The hearer is no more separate from the speaker. Few people here come to that state many times, to the state of musin. When you are not separate from me, when suddenly boundaries merge, when suddenly we overlap, in that moment the communication, in that moment the transfer, then anything will do. My silence will do, my word will do. Any gesture of my hand will do. You have to be in musin, a state of mind which has no ego, which has no boundary. Only in this state God is possible, nirvana is possible. There is a famous haiku of Basu, the old pond. A frog jumps in, plop. It is said, Basu was sitting by the side of an old pond, very ancient pond. And on the rock was sitting a frog. It must have been a sunny morning, and the frog must have been enjoying a sun bath, and Basu was watching, just silently sitting there, must have been in a state of musin. The old pond, a frog jumps in, plop, and the sound of the frog jumping in the old pond, plop, and it is said Basu became enlightened. That plop was enough to make him awake. Yes, in Muslim, even this plop is enough. This governor must have been a very, very intelligent man. Standing outside the master's door, he must have been coming slowly, slowly, to a certain glimpse of Muslim. And when the attendant came, and with apologies said, "Sir, the master is not willing to see you. He has rejected it. He says, I don't want to see this fellow." Plop! Something happened in that moment. The governor recognized his error. And then he became a totally different man. Then he is no more the same man. Yes, it can happen in a single moment. It is a question of pure understanding. This cuckoo can do it. Plop. Just wind passing through these trees can do it. Plop. It is possible. The impossible is possible if you are in Muslim. And Zen is nothing but a discipline how to attain this Muslim, this state of no mind. Enough for today.